Benvenuti ad Alma Lectio, il podcast dell'Università di Bologna dedicato alle Lectio Magistralis tenute da scienziati, intellettuali e personaggi illustri che nel corso degli anni sono stati invitati dall'Università di Bologna a condividere il loro sapere e contribuire alla divulgazione della conoscenza. Nella puntata di oggi ascoltiamo Jean-Claude Trichet, banchiere e economista francese, per anni presidente della Banca Centrale Europea, che ha pronunciato la sua lezione dottorale il 17 settembre 2012 nell'Aula Magna di Santa Lucia, in occasione del conferimento della laurea d'honorem in Scienze Statistiche dell'Università di Bologna. Buon ascolto!
Monsieur le Recteur, Madame la Doyenne, Dante Alighieri, dans son livre « De l'éloquence vulgaire », explique que dans ce livre, il ne va pas parler du latin, mais de la langue vulgaire. Et il dit « Je pourrais vous parler de la langue d'oc, de la langue d'oil ou de l'italien. Mais comme je suis italien moi-même, je vais vous parler de l'italien. » Vous me pardonnerez, peut-être puis-je demander à Dante Alighieri de me pardonner de ne parler ni la langue vulgaire italienne, ni la langue vulgaire française, la langue d'Oyle, mais l'anglais, si vous le permettez. So, Mr. Rector, Mrs. Dean of the Statistical Science Faculty, Excellencies, members of Parliament, very, very dear friends that I see just in front of me, including the Saul of Banca d'Italia, who's there, I would say that I am extremely moved. Of course, you don't need to read any history book when you are in this extraordinary place to see that we are here in the oldest university in Italy, the oldest university in Europe, and I understand, Mr. Rector, the oldest university in the Western world. And I have also to say that hearing the Gaudeamus igitur, which was just sung, is also extremely moving. You have, Mrs. Dean of the faculty, been very eloquent, of course, much too flattering as regards what I did, but I know that it is la loi du genre. But I have to say that I share with you the thought that it is extremely important that we continue to improve statistics, that we continue to improve the help that the economic science can have, because we are experiencing extraordinarily difficult times, times that are extraordinarily demanding, times that had called us to go out of the textbooks, to embark in new avenues, to accept non-standard measures, and to encourage very active research in the new avenues of economic research. I don't stress more that, but I think that it is extremely important. And of course, your university is a center of research which is of extreme importance in the present world. We are, as I said, living extraordinarily difficult times. And I think that they call for further European integration. When people seek a justification for European integration, there is a tendency to look backwards. In particular, that European integration, which is true, has banished the spectra of war from our continent. It is true also that we had the longest period of peace and prosperity in European history. This perspective is entirely correct, but it is also incomplete. There are many more reasons for striving towards ever closer union in Europe today than there were in 1945. And these reasons are entirely forward-looking. 65 years ago, the distribution of global GDP was such that Europe had only one role model for its single market. It was the United States of America. Today, Europe is faced with a new global economy, reconfigured by globalization and by the emerging economies of Asia and Latin America. It is a world where economies of scale and networks of innovation matter more than ever. By 2016, very, very soon, we can expect the euro area in terms of purchasing power parity to be at the level of below the GDP of China. It will remain over and above the GDP of India. But together, these two countries would represent around twice in purchasing power parity terms the GDP of the euro area. Over a longer horizon, the entire GDP of the G7 countries will be dwarfed by the rapid development of the systemic emerging economies. Europe has to cope with a new geopolitical landscape, which is very profoundly reshaped by these emerging economies. And Europe is also faced with new global challenges, where effective solutions are possible only at the European and at vast international levels. In this new global constellation, European integration, both economic and political, is central to achieved prosperity, long-lasting prosperity and stability and influence. The challenge is to set the correct path of European integration. Getting this right is essential to realize fully our continent's tremendous potential. Let me therefore lay out a vision for the Europe of tomorrow. The creation of Europe's monetary, economic and monetary union is unique in the history of sovereign states. The euro area constitutes a society of states of a completely new time. We have created progressively a concept which goes far beyond the Westphalian concept of sovereign states. Like individuals in a society, euro area countries are both independent and interdependent. Good governance requires that both individual member states and the institution of the EU fulfill their responsibilities. We have observed the functioning of the euro area for 13 years. As all advanced economies, we have experienced the shock of the crisis over the last 5 years. It is time now to draw lessons from these first years. And I know I say that in front of the previous president of the Commission, which I'm so happy to see here. It's very, very flattering. Thank you very much for being present, Mr. President. Well, a word on the successes of the monetary union. I will not expand too much on the successes of monetary union, but we have a monetary union and we have an economic union. I really trust that the monetary union, the MU part of the acronym EMU, has been successful. And of course that we have to improve the economic union, the EU part of the acronym. But let me only mention that the new currency, starting from scratch, has maintained price stability for an entire continent of now 332 million people. The average inflation over the first 13, and when we compute at the end of the year, 14 years, would have been very, very close to 2%, which is in line, taking into account the oil shocks that we had to cope with the definition of price stability. The savers and market participants are trusting the euro to keep its domestic value as well in the future. I mentioned that en passant. The euro is credible, and it is demonstrated every day by the markets, the euro as a currency, the currency. And third, I have to say that not only what we have done is in line with the mandate received by the European Central Banks and the euro system from the European democracies, but also better than what was displayed in Europe before the euro, so that all countries in Europe, all public opinion in Europe could be said, including those who had the benefit of very stable currency, we delivered stability even better than it was the case before with the national currencies. And I have also to say that this level of stability, I am of course prudent and cautious there, but it is true that the level of stability was not against job creation when I compute the job creation since the start of the euro. I already said that it is not very well known. Since the 1st January 1999, the start of the euro, up to the first quarter of 2012, this year, last figures that we have computed, the euro area has created around 14.1 million new jobs. During the same period, the United States of America have created around 9.1 million new jobs. So it is significantly more in Europe. This is not known. It doesn't mean that we are satisfied with what we have done. Unemployment is much too high in Europe, and we have a lot of hard work to do to eliminating the structural obstacles to growth that we have. And again, I don't want to say that everything goes well. It is not true, and we are in the epicenter of a very, very difficult crisis. But nevertheless, I wanted to mention that en passant, because there is a tendency to see all what's happening on our continent only through negative grids. It does not deserve, fortunately, only negative grids. Now, let's concentrate on the weaknesses of the economic union. The major weaknesses that we have are not at the level of the European euro area as a whole. As a whole, the current account of the euro area is balanced. The public debt outstanding as a proportion of GDP is well below the Japanese public debt outstanding, and the yearly public finance deficits is well below the equivalent figures in the US, in Japan, and in the United Kingdom. Still, we have several factors, including the absence of effective surveillance inside the euro area, that have created a large dispersion of situations between countries as regards fiscal soundness, competitiveness, and therefore creditworthiness. This explains why some countries are regarded by investors and savers as vulnerable. I would suggest that we can list the weaknesses of the euro area economic governance in six propositions. First, the Stability and Growth Pact, designed to ensure sound fiscal policies in the euro area, has not been correctly implemented. Furthermore, in 2003 and 2004, the major countries, namely France, Italy, and Germany, engaged in a dramatic move to weaken the pact. Romano Prodi has some memory of that because he engaged in a trial as Commission against the Council. The defense of the Commission, of the ECB, and of the small and medium-sized countries contributed to avoid the dismantling of the letter of the pact, but the spirit of the pact has been gravely impacted. Second, the governance of the euro area did not comprehend monitoring and surveillance of competitiveness indicators, of nominal evolutions of prices and costs in any particular nation, and of national external imbalances within the euro area. In the view of the ECB, this was abnormal. In 2005, long before the crisis, on behalf of the Governing Council, I called for an appropriate surveillance of a number of national indicators, including the unit labor cost evolution. Third point, the high correlation between the creditworthiness of the commercial banks of a particular country and the creditworthiness of the signature of sovereign states creates an additional vulnerability which is particularly damaging in the euro area in time of global crisis and calls for a banking union. Fourth, no crisis management tools had been envisaged at the start of the euro. One has to recognize in this respect that benign neglect was generalized all over the world at the time of the setting up of the euro, particularly in the advanced economies. All advanced economies, not only Europe. Fifth, another weakness of the euro area has been the unsatisfactory completion of the single market in the domain of goods and particularly services. This weakness of the single market of the European Union as a whole, the 27, is particularly resented in the euro area, where it hampers the functioning of the competitive channel, which is essential for a correct adjustment of the economies concerned. And sixth, similarly, the relatively slow implementation of the structural reforms foreseen in the Lisbon Agenda and in the 2020 program, which were and are engaged at the level of the 27, at the level of the European Union as a whole, is hampering also the smooth functioning of the euro area. In many of these domains, fortunately, important progresses have been made. The six packs are incorporating very significant improvements of the Stability and Growth Pact, as well as the creation of a new pillar for the surveillance of competitive indicators and excessive national imbalances. As regards the banking sector, I trust that a banking union helping to disconnect the commercial banks from the creditworthiness of their sovereign is an appropriate concept. Its implementation could start with the direct recapitalization of some banks in Spain in particular. Very new significant crisis management tools have been put in place so that the first four weaknesses that I have previously listed are in the process of correction, including thanks to the recent decision of the Karlsruhe Court. Very comprehensive, expeditious, and swift implementation of the measures already decided is of the essence. And there is a consensus to consider that the completion of the single market and the structural reforms that are overdue at the level of the 27 are important endeavors for the stability and prosperity of the European Union, even if there are still resistances here and there. But as I already said publicly, I trust that we have to go further in engineering a quantum leap for economic and for fiscal governance. We have to introduce elements for an economic and fiscal federation that would be fully democratic. The Commission itself is calling for proceeding in this direction. I would like to stress more particularly the benefits that governance in the euro area could draw from a significant change in the process of close monitoring of national policies embedded in the two surveillance pillars mentioned earlier. I imagine, and of course what I say is only to trigger meditation and reflection and to be more precise of what we could do, because there are a number of avenues that could be envisaged. One of these avenues, which call for discussions because it has, of course, pros and cons, assets and liabilities. But one idea could be that instead of imposing fines to the countries that would transgress the rules and not apply the recommendations, you could activate a new decision-making process. In these exceptional circumstances, of course, it would call for absolutely exceptional circumstances at the level of Europe and at the level of one particular country. The European authorities, Commission, Council, and this is essential, the Parliament, the European Parliament, could decide directly on measures immediately executed in the country concerned. And in domains that would be defined in the budget and in some part of economic policies, We could therefore have a concept of activation in exceptional cases of a euro area economic and fiscal federation by exception. That, in my opinion, could be worth again weighing the pros and cons. First, the concept according to which sharing a single currency also means accepting limitations to fiscal sovereignty is not new. The Stability and Growth Pact comprehends the possibility of imposing sanctions in the form of fines, including very significant fines, to a government or a parliament, or if a government or a parliament or both are not meeting the provisions and not respecting the Commission and Council recommendations. The new concept I suggest studying draws the consequences from the fact that the fines would have proved ineffective. But again, limiting fiscal sovereignty in exceptional cases, in very exceptional cases, and upon judgment made at the level of the center, was already in the Maastricht Treaty. Second, I trust that it could be considered in line with the concept of subsidiarity, which has been applied in Europe, all over the European construction, and since the introduction of the Stability and Growth Pact. As long as the policy which is pursued is in line with the framework, there is absolutely no need for anything, and certainly not for sanctions. When the policy pursued is threatening to contradict the overall limits incorporated in the framework and threatening the stability of the system as a whole, the stability of all the fellow citizens in Europe, then perhaps the concept of subsidiarity can be alleviated. Third, perhaps the most important element in what I have in mind, again, for discussion, would be the strong democratic anchoring. It is absolutely necessary that such an activation of a federation by exception would be subject to a fully democratic decision-making process, that democratic accountability would be absolutely indisputable, and that the reason why the European Parliament should be called to play a fundamental role in the decision on top of the traditional role played by the Commission and the Council. More precisely, for the decision to be effective, the European Parliament would have to approve by a majority vote the measures proposed by the Commission and already approved by the Council. Naturally, as long as the euro area does not coincide with the European Union as a whole, only the members of parliament elected in the countries member of the euro area would vote. It would be necessary to organize in the best fashion possible the dialogue between the European Parliament and the national parliament of the country concerned and of the countries of the euro area in these exceptional circumstances where the stability and the prosperity of the euro area as a whole would be at stake. The national parliament should have the possibility of explaining why it could not implement the recommendations proposed. Symmetrically, the European Parliament could explain why the stability and the prosperity of the euro area as a whole is at stake. That being said, in the activation of this economic and fiscal federation by exception, after a deep and appropriate dialogue between the two institutions, the last decision would belong to the European Parliament. It seems to me that in such, again, exceptional circumstances, the legitimacy of the participation of all members of the European Parliament elected in the euro area countries seems to be very justified. It would be indeed their own electorate stability and prosperity which would be put at risk in such exceptional circumstances. I have to say that the euro area is presently learning the hard way that the level of interconnectedness between economies and countries inside a single currency area is such that even an economy of a modest size can impact significantly the euro area as a whole. So I would say that all these ideas, again, have to be discussed. We could imagine other avenues, for instance, the embryo of a real federal budget that would grow progressively over time. These are also avenues that deserve attention. And I don't think that anybody can say that it has the right solution. It is history in the making, I have to say. And it is a great privilege, as you mentioned, the Chinese way of looking at crisis time, Madame Montanari. I very much share that view, those views. I mentioned already the interest that we would have if we have had a Ministry of Finance in the euro area. I mentioned the necessity to be able to make quantum leaps as regards the governance. And of course, this governance has to be democratic, which calls for political union. And again, the fact that we would imply very profoundly in exceptional circumstances and cases, the European Parliament would be, of course, a jump towards real political union. All that being said, again, I am aware of the boldness of some of the ideas that are presented here. I would only say we have now the benefit of almost 14 years of experience of the euro area. We see what are the assets and liabilities of the EMU as we started. We have already identified all the avenues in which we have to improve, and we have already taken decision. I think that we have not only to implement actively and swiftly at the level of individual countries, as well as at the level of Europe as a whole, all what has been decided, and a lot has already been decided, swift implementation of all what has been decided without hesitation would, in my opinion, improve very significantly confidence in each country and confidence in Europe as a whole. But it seems to me legitimate, nevertheless, to continue to reflect on the longer term, and I know that the Commission is fully on that line after the speech which has been delivered by President Barroso, fully in line, I have to say, with what President Brody had himself said in his time. Jean Monnet said famously, "People only accept change when they are faced with necessity and only recognize necessity when a crisis is upon them." The crisis is upon us. It's certainly time to move ahead. Thank you very much for your attention.
Avete ascoltato la lezione dottorale che Jean-Claude Trichet, banchiere e economista francese, per anni presidente della Banca Centrale Europea, ha pronunciato il 17 settembre 2012 nell'Aula Magna di Santa Lucia in occasione del conferimento della laurea d'honorem in Scienze Statistiche dell'Università di Bologna. Vi aspettiamo alla prossima Alma Lectio!